Thanks, Ross. Now, you've got me scared about the magic thing. Where do I point it? Not working at all? Nope.
No.
All right, my slides might be a bit trickier. So let's see. If we can go to the next slide, but just push it once, if you can. Nope. Excellent. You've probably seen... Well, first of all, I'm just going to stress that I'm going to talk about the experience we've had in Perth. Working? Not working.
Okay.
Ah. The experience we've had in Perth. One of the most annoying things that happens in Western Australia is that people from other states come and give us advice. So I wouldn't dare to go to another state and give advice. So I'm going to tell you our story and why we did what we did and how we did it. But I am not saying that it's what anyone else should do. That's my disclaimer at the start. Now, everybody's seen the bar graphs of rainfall runoff into dams, and I thought you're sick to death of those, so I'll give you, we'll do it in a different version. So this is the graph of runoff into our dams since the 1950s. And if you start to plot a trend line, you start to see a rather depressing scenario. Now, we didn't just ignore this. What we've done over time is in the 1950s, because you can see we had years of very wet weather and years of very dry weather, so our solution was to build bigger dams so that when you had wet weather you could hold it for when you had dry weather. By the 1970s, it was clear that this may not be solution enough. We introduced pay-for-use water supply. Prior to that, it was a flat bill for water. We started actually paying by the quantity people used. And a lot of people in Perth put in shallow bores for their garden, and we started using groundwater for urban water supply. In the 1990s, we started significant water efficiency measures and started looking at the way we water our gardens. And in the 2000s, 2001 was really our year, winter from hell, where we had almost no net runoff for the year. And that year, we changed some of our planning solutions. We introduced our, what were called our water efficiency measures, which means a two-day-a-week sprinkler roster, rather than full sprinkler bans, which would destroy the gardening industry. And we started looking at alternative and climate-independent sources like desalination. Now, if you run the trend line down, what you see is that reliance on surface water for Western Australia's south is a very risky scenario. And in fact, it's a scenario that's doomed to failure in the long term. So let's have a look at what the West Australian water supply looks like. This map is the scheme as it looked in 1993. Dams in the south, groundwater in the north, Wanneroo and Mirrabooka are large groundwater treatment plants, and an integrated network to kind of join the two of them up, with a very long pipeline, nearly 400 kilometres long, courtesy of C.Y. O'Connor, built in the 1890s, all the way out to Kalgoorlie and the goldfields. The system's very flexible and designed so that heavy rain running into the dams and causing a mud event can be negated because we can run the entire scheme off groundwater from the north and we can reverse flow in most of our mains. So a very flexible and quite robust scheme, but one that by 1993 wasn't keeping pace with Perth's growth and with the lack of rainfall runoff. So we built a heap of stuff. In fact, we implemented our 30-year plan in about a 10-year period. We built more dams in the south and took some existing pumpback schemes and integrated them with significant pipelines into the network. We expanded the bore fields in the north. We built QWRP, K-W-R-P, the Kwinana Wastewater Recycling Plant, so that recycled water is supplied to industry in the Kwinana area. And in fact, the scheme was a very robust one. But by 2001, and that winter from hell, it was clear we needed a better plan. And that's when the Perth Desalination Plant really came onto the horizon. And the next plan, which is underway imminently, is the Southern Seawater Desalination Plant, which gives us the final piece in our puzzle and should give us water certainty through to about 2020. So the desal story. Now, this is a long and busy slide, and I'm not actually going to talk to it. I'm just going to talk a bit about our journey. In July 2001, when it was clear that we had to come up with a better plan, we had two scenarios we were working through with the corporation. One was seawater desalination, and the second was tapping into the southwest Yarragadee, a very big aquifer quite a long way south of Perth, and a groundwater source about a kilometre deep. We ran both options in parallel, and it became clear that on cost basis at that stage environmentally we were closer to a desal solution. We went to the market for partners for desalination, chose two, an alliance between grouping of Multiplex and Degremont, and another grouping of Veolia and Leighton and United KG, and we deemed both of these preferred proponents, but we then stopped our process while we reviewed all of the options that we had available and went back to relook at South West Yarragadee. In July 2004, the government made the call that they would go for seawater desalination, and so we started the process in earnest. Now, our contracting strategy was to go for a design, construct, operate and maintain alliance, which is really a PPP with our own money. We were lucky in a way that we had the 2-year hiatus in our process, because during this period we seconded a number of Water Corporation staff into operations and utilities using Seawater RO, and we became a much more informed buyer through that process. We did a lot of research ourselves, and we had a partner in Fichtner, a German consultant, who were very strong in desal in the Middle East, to work with us to actually educate our staff and our engineers and our operators into some of the basics of desal. But our thinking was that we were not experts in the field, so we needed a partner. But for the long haul, what we were experts at was integrating water into our water supply and generically running plants. So we chose the alliance model because for us it was the best of both worlds. The alliance model really shares risk, and we spent a lot of time working out what were the risks for the entire project and the operation of the project, and then allocating those risks to the parties best able to take them. For example, over time, over a 25-year operating contract, the risk of the increase in cost of things like labour and chemicals was better to be taken by us as the corporation, because we are probably the biggest buyer of water chemicals in the state, so we have some bargaining power, but also our income stream is pretty well linked to inflation, certainly over a 25-year period. And having a private sector proponent bidding that back to us and taking risk on it and putting a margin on that risk didn't seem appropriate. But the amount of power consumed by the plant, the amount of chemicals consumed by the plant, and the labour involved to run the plant, the magnitude of that was clearly in our partner's control. So we have an alliance model where we're all incentivised to do well in the bits we control, and the things that no one can control, we share risk on equally. It was a very strong model and worked brilliantly for us. Having the two parts of the project, the design and construct and the operations and maintenance linked in together, really meant that the right drivers were embedded in the whole process. There were fascinating discussions where our partners were arguing for higher cost and better reliability pumps on a project so that the long-term maintenance costs would be less. And because they were paying for it out of a pretty well fixed pool, it was kind of the reverse of the normal contractor discussions. It was a great project. We had a lot of difficulty picking our winner, but we did pick our winner, and we started on site at the very end of April 2005. The site, as you can see, is predominantly made of white sand, as is the bulk of the Perth metropolitan area. And we started with some test work of our water supply, of the inlet water, final test work then to determine final pretreatment, and got going on construction. It was an enormously fast-tracked construction project. This is the site from the year in October 2005. Now, the pond of green scummy water is absolutely nothing to do with the desalination plant. It's owned by local power generator, who also owns the three big diesel tanks you can see there and the pile of black scummy looking stuff. They are our neighbour, and that is they were their assets. This is the plant a year later. You can see that our clear water tank is under construction, the large Bunnings workshop type shed is under construction, the festively blue coloured filters are well and truly in place. These filters are basically what you have in your backyard if you have a swimming pool. They're a dual media sand and anthracite filter, pressure filter. You still have the scummy pond owned by Western Power. But the adjacent area where the pile of black-looking muck was is now a very flat pad, which is, again, nothing to do with us and the site of the next new-gen power station for our colleagues, Western Power. And this was the plant earlier the following year, when we'd opened it officially. We had first water out in November 2006. You can see the new power station taking shape to the south, to the north, sorry, and the plant itself with the boundary shown. The green scummy tank of a pond of water is unfortunately still there, and one of the learnings I've had through this process is that when you site something in an industrial area, everybody blames you for everything they can see. Behind us is a power station with chimneys, and so you get people telling you it's appalling, the terrible pollution you're putting into the atmosphere from your chimneys. And I say, I haven't got a chimney, but minor details. It was an absolutely brilliant project for us, went very, very well. Our timing was superb. When the government announced the decision, and there was some negative feedback about knee-jerk reactions and short-termist solutions, but at the same time, our state government were building a large railway with an underground section through the city. This had enormous industrial attention. We basically said nothing about the plant. We allowed no visitors. Despite every politician in Australia being interested in desal at this stage, we said, for safety reasons, we're not allowing visitors to the site. Most people were kind of didn't really think about it much. It was a pretty much a non-event. We had a display at the Royal Show in September 2006, which was how desal works. The number one question was, when are you going to start construction? And we opened the plant 6 weeks later. So it was a brilliant project for us. Our timing was superb in costing terms. It was the first major seawater RO plant built outside the Middle East. We were able to get long lead time items like major pumps and membranes on very good delivery schedules and very good pricing schedules. And it coincided with the very start of the absolutely insane boom that Western Australia has seen. So, brilliant project, great fun, marvellous all round. So, if we go now to some of the environmental considerations, it fascinates me how excited people get about the environmental considerations. Power is seen and cited by everyone as the bogey person or the bogeyman. It's bizarre to me that the railway that was being built at the same time, called the electric railway, which is a clue that it might have power involved, uses way more power than a desal plant. But it's a fabulously environmentally sound process because it gets cars off the road. Having people run out of water, having the garden industry non-existent, having Perth a dust bowl doesn't get seen in the same light at all somehow. We purchase our energy from a wind farm. We are not purchasing renewable energy or green power, and we don't use those terms. We have a back-to-back agreement with the wind farm, and for every kilowatt hour of power we consume in our plant, we purchase a kilowatt hour of power from the wind farm. There are a myriad of rules about RECs and things. We complied with all the rules at the time. The rules have subsequently changed. So I will tell you that we purchase energy which is generated in a renewable manner, and that's our claim to fame, and that doesn't fit very nicely on a T-shirt. But in the same way that if you have a hot water heater, a solar hot water heater on the roof of your house, the RECs associated with that you don't purchase when you purchase your heater. Traditionally they go to your local power utility or they're unsold, but you can't say that you are creating greenhouse gases in heating your water. We haven't bought the RECs, but we are not creating additional greenhouse gases in power being generated. People have written PhD theses on this topic, so I'm not going to go into it in any more detail. Our plant itself is in the middle of an industrial area, which does give us unsightly neighbours, but does mean that those neighbours are less concerned about issues to do with aesthetics, noise, etc., although I think our plant is surprisingly beautiful. Our ocean diffuser has 48 ports, and our environmental license requires us to be within 1% of background salinity within 50 metres of the diffuser. Now, those of you who understand desalination or seawater RO will know that for roughly every 2 litres of seawater we draw in, we end up with 1 litre of pure water and 1 litre of twice as salty seawater. It's a sieving process. We're basically just taking water at very high pressure, putting it through a sieve, and in very simple terms, letting the water molecules go through and the bigger other molecules, including salt and impurities, not go through. So the waste stream going into the ocean is predominantly twice as salty seawater with very little else added. The bulk of the cleaning products, most of the time, now there are some backwash cycles involving slightly worse things, but most of them are basically citric acid and bicarbonate of soda. So we're not talking noxious chemicals in any magnitude for the bulk of the operating time. So the seawater going out is not the concentrated brine stream in people's minds with great crusty salt bits hanging off it. And no, we're not going to recycle it for the salt industry, because to evaporate it we'd need an area about the size of the Perth metropolitan area. And so what's going back into Cockburn Sound on a day is seawater that is mixed very rapidly and very quickly within 50 metres of the diffuser. The amount of water, fresh water, that comes out of Cockburn Sound every day is approximately 1/40th of the average evaporation over Cockburn Sound over a day. So Cockburn Sound is not getting noticeably saltier, and fish are not dying, and we're not dragging the marine life by the bucket load into our inlet. In fact, our inlet is a gravity-fed inlet. Water flows at a very slow rate, less than 0.1 of a metre per second. So what happens is that the little fish that do come into the inlet can swim out, and in fact our underwater videos show a wonderful ecosystem of little fish darting in and out to escape bigger fish who are swimming in the area. The only issue we have ever had is jellyfish. If a particularly large swarm of jellyfish, I don't think it's a swarm, I think it's actually called a smuck, I was reading, a smuck of jellyfish comes past, they can get drawn in. I don't believe they're an endangered species and anyone's overly worried about it, but they'd make a bit of a mess of your inlet screens, and that's happened to us once since we've been operating. And tiny pieces of marine larvae and bits of seaweed do come in, and we generate about an industrial skip a week of scrapings off the primary inlet screens. I guess one of the interesting things about desal has been the way energy use in seawater RO has dropped over time. About 10 years ago, it was around 8 kilowatt hours a kilolitre. Our plant's operating at the gate, including all of the treatment and post-treatment and pumping, at about 3.8 kilowatt hours a kilolitre, largely due to the breakthroughs in energy recovery. Because as I was explaining, when half of the water, the seawater, becomes fresh water and goes off into your pipeline, it loses all its energy when it becomes fresh water, but the twice as salty seawater has still got the very high pumping energy. So we have an energy recovery system that strips the energy out of that and inputs it into the incoming seawater, and that's how most of the breakthroughs have occurred in energy efficiency. The plant at Gold Coast that's just been commissioned uses energy at about the same rate we do, but our new plant, the plant that we are about to start construction, we're expecting to have energy use marginally lower, around 3.6 kilowatt hours per kilolitre, largely due to changes in plant layout and some of the breakpoints in the way you operate the plant, rather than the actual membrane technology. Now, environmental monitoring is extreme for our plant. We at the start of the project, we commissioned some world experts to do some analysis of what was known about monitoring for outfalls and ocean monitoring worldwide about desal. And they told us that at the start of our project, we had already contributed 500% of the knowledge that existed in the world in this area. Because most of the big plants are built in the Middle East. And I don't know how many people in the room have visited them, but most of them have an open channel flow. Most of them use ferric chloride as a coagulant in their pre-treatment, which is, you know, red and rusty and brown, and most of them have their open channel flow ending at the low watermark. So there is almost, whilst the ferric chloride isn't noxious to or harmful to the environment, it's brown. And we thought the plan of putting brown muck into Cockburn Sound was probably not one of our better strategies we could have come up with, so that one got rejected in about a millisecond. So our elaborate diffusers are monitored at source, and we monitor in four other places in Cockburn Sound. We monitor at four different depths of water, and we're monitoring 24/7. And in fact, we have proven that for the 5 years before our plant was built, every summer the very deepest part of Cockburn Sound goes anoxic in autumn, or late summer, early autumn, when we get low wind events. This was happening before our plant was built. It's happened out of the 3 years we've been operating, it's happened 1 year since. The environmental regulator required us to shut the plant down for a few weeks while that event was occurring. We've strenuously protested against that because it goes anoxic with or without us. There have been no incidences ever recorded since white settlement of fish deaths due to this anoxic behaviour, because contrary to popular belief, fish are smart enough to swim away when there's no oxygen in the bit of water they're in. And we'll continue monitoring, and in fact our modelling shows that we actually raise the oxygen levels of the very deep sound because the water we're producing has been pumped at 65 bar, so it's quite oxygenated. So we were very pleased with our plant. It's operated very well. The community acceptance has been very high, bar one woman who wrote to us just before the plant was started complaining about a strange fishy taste in her water. The temptation to write back and suggest adding more scotch was... I was afraid I was overruled on that answer. So we then proceeded to look at our water supply going forward. Our plan had always been to then start work on our second major source, which was the Southwest Yarragadee. Southwest Yarragadee was the first water project in Australia to undergo a full sustainability analysis, but it was killed off by public opinion. Very emotive campaign about groundwater dropping, killing off the southwest. And in the meantime, we were looking as part of our 10, 20, 30 year program for future desal sites. Somewhat to our surprise, our premier of the day announced that we would not be doing Southwest Yarragadee, we would be building another desal plant. And he picked one of our future sites that was fairly undeveloped at that stage, which was Binningup. We weren't overly stressed. We'd done a bit of work on Binningup, not a lot of work, and we'd would have preferred to have developed the Southwest Yarragadee, but we had the technical capacity to do either. People of Binningup weren't so excited, and I guess that probably mirrors some of the issues you've had in this state. So that brings us to the Southern Seawater Desalination Plant, which is sized at 50 gigalitres per annum, slightly larger than Perth 1, but it's scalable up to 100 gigalitres, and all of our environmental approvals are for the 100 gigalitre site. It's quite a long way further south of Perth than our existing plant. This is because we have major infrastructure to bring water up from the dams, and for us the cost of integrating any new source is usually around the same cost as the new source. So this was a reasonable cost option for us. And most of the pipeline that we do have to build can be sited in road reserves, so it's a minimal public impact. There is a very small town of Binningup adjacent to it who were not pleased about this announcement. But you can see it's very open sea, very good mixing conditions, and it's in pretty much in just bush. We've purchased an old limestone quarry, so the plant itself will be sited in a disused limestone quarry, and all our inlet and outlet works will be tunnelled. So the impact is minimal, and the completed plant has an 8-metre berm around it, which will be wooded again so that it won't be visible from anywhere. What this caused was a lot of engagement with the community in a way that we would prefer not to do. Corporation prides itself on very positive engagement, and we found ourselves on the back foot. First public meeting had 500 hostile local residents and their friends. We're down to a group of six who are the Binningup Action Group, who we're working with quite closely. The cynics would say the rest of the Shire of Binningup are building lunch bars and opening Jiffy food vans in anticipation of the construction crews. But the engagement has been strong, and it's been a huge lesson to us in not allowing government to be disconnected from our, or not allowing us and government to disconnect from our processes. So seawater desalination is not the devil incarnate or evil. I am absolutely amazed when I come to the East Coast at the strength of feeling. It is just such a ho-hum issue in Western Australia. But it's exciting to be exciting, I guess. In my mind, having part of your water supply system rainfall independent is a no-brainer. Those graphs of dam levels that Ross showed you showed our dams at 30% full, and that's because our dams only supply at present 40% of our water supply. We have 1/6 from Perth desal plant. We have about 40% from surface water sources, and the rest comes from groundwater. when the Southern Seawater Desalination Plant is commissioned, we'll have about a third climate independent, which gives us a lot more flexibility as we go forward. Drinking water quality issues caused by the environment don't affect us. We can site plants close to our existing infrastructure to minimise pumping costs, and the pumping costs, as Ross also showed you, are hugely significant. Environmental issues can be managed. People forget that building a dam destroys thousands of hectares of bush. People forget that groundwater needs to be pumped and treated. Every solution has pluses and minuses. There's no silver bullet. But to reject one of them because it sounds fabricated rather than natural is, to me, very short-sighted. The changes are happening fast. And in fact, if you look, as Ross had said about the cost of water heating, it costs the average householder five times as much in power to heat the water that comes out of their shower heads as it would to desalinate all of the water that they consume in their home. So the bottom line is, we're very proud of the fact that some of our water is climate independent, but there is no silver bullet. It's part of a holistic strategy. Our aim is to make the southwest of Western Australia climate resilient. You can only do that working with your community and working with the environment. No one can work alone. We have a three-pronged attack to reduce water use, to maximise reuse and to develop new sources. Desalination is a key part, but not the only part, of developing new sources, and we plan to be thinking about the next 50 years every day for the next 50 years. Thank you.